The following podcast is part of a certified educational activity titled Making an Impact in Bladder Cancer Care, integrating the latest evidence and modern therapeutic advances across the disease continuum. Access the entire activity and complete the post-test at peerview.com/JSQ860. Downloadable slides and practice aids are also available.
Hi, everyone. Yes. Welcome. Please take your seats. Thanks for joining tonight. Tonight for this symposium, Making an Impact in Bladder Cancer Care, Integrating the Latest Evidence and Modern Therapeutic Advances Across the Disease Continuum. I'm Matt Galsky. I'm a medical oncologist at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, and I'm joined here by my colleagues who need no introduction, but I'm going to introduce them anyway, Dr. Shilpa Gupta and Dr. Andrea Necki, both experts in bladder cancer care. And so our goals for today are to augment your knowledge on the care across the disease spectrum for bladder cancer, equip you with skills to incorporate new approaches into the management of the disease, and provide guidance on how to manage adverse events. So as mentioned, I'm Matt Galsky. To set the stage a little bit for the first part of the program, which we'll talk about non-muscle invasive bladder cancer and muscle invasive bladder cancer, only about a third of patients with non-muscle invasive bladder cancer receive BCG. There are BCG shortages ongoing, which contributes to some of that, but there are other reasons as well. In patients with muscle invasive bladder cancer, a large subset of our patients don't get curative intent treatment, and patients who do undergo cystectomy, of course, have some life-changing implications regarding that therapy. And so there's multiple unmet needs in this disease. There's certainly a need for implementation science. There's a need to listen to our patients in terms of what they want, in what questions they want answered in the forms of clinical trials moving forward. So we're going to hear about some new approaches that I think are starting to take all of these bits of input about unmet needs into consideration and design treatments for the future. Team-based care is critical in patients with bladder cancer. This is a multidisciplinary disease throughout the disease continuum. We're seeing that more in non-muscle invasive disease. As medical oncologists, we're seeing patients more and more frequently. And I think at the other end of the spectrum, we're seeing that more commonly as the treatments that we get, the systemic treatments that we get for metastatic disease get better. We are seeing, unfortunately, some patients developing recurrences within the bladder who have well-controlled disease outside of the bladder, and the care of the urologist is required on an ongoing basis. Beacon is really an excellent source for patient education materials. I refer all my patients to the Beacon website. I know I can trust the material, and there's lots of different types of material depending on how your patients and their caregivers learn the best. So I'm pleased to introduce Dr. Andrea Necki, who is going to take us through therapeutic regimens in non-muscle invasive disease and muscle invasive bladder cancer.
Thank you, Matt. Welcome, everyone. Good evening. First of all, I'm sorry for my voice. Please accept my apologies. I will try to make my voice live till the end of the session. So my task is to provide you and to navigate together with you across the possibilities for treatment, the new possibilities for treatment in patients with non-muscle invasive disease. We will see what is going on in this difficult to treat patient population. First of all, we are lucky as investigators and clinicians working on this disease because of the fact that we have established paradigms for patient selection first. We have a shared model, a shared clinical model upon which building on clinical trials. So the first definition is the high-risk non-muscle invasive disease. It is pretty shared in the community of oncologists and urologists, and is including what is shown here. So you will be available, you will be able to download the slides to see in the details what is included in this definition. But the main message that I would provide to you is that we do have the possibility to define patients with with the highest risk for non-muscle invasive disease. And we do also have criteria to define adequate BCG exposure in order to be able to define disease which can consider kind of a BCG unresponsive or BCG refractory disease. And we do have also an FDA endorsed definition of BCG unresponsive disease. And it is defined here, as you can see on this slide. So a good background in general that is available for us in order to provide the patients with the right treatment possibility and maybe the right clinical trial possibility in the today and in the near future. So in this slide, I try to summarize the outstanding advances and the many data that have been proposed and published or presented in non-muscle invasive disease. You see here that we have a contribution of medical oncologists, as I am in this urology space, with immune checkpoint inhibitor. We do have the first data on targeted therapy in this regard, with the use of FGF receptor inhibitors in particular. And we do have outstanding data from the initial attempts to deliver intravesically newer therapies, like GZ007, or same drug with pembrolizumab, or TAR-200 therapy, we'll see in the next few slides, or other gene therapy or immune therapy delivered intravesically, including studies, retrospective studies with intravesical chemotherapy that provided interesting results and that are used in the primarily in the United States in this disease. And lastly, the attempts to shift the administration of systemic therapy like EV in fortumavirotin intravesically in this patient. So a lot of movement in this space. If you remember what was available until 1 year, 2 years, 3 years ago, outstanding steps forward have been made through clinical trials. So we will try to navigate very briefly to the main results of these studies. The first data, the pivotal study, was at KEYNOTE-57. That was the first study investigating in systemic immune therapy in this patient population. The initial data were quite promising. In the short-term CR rate in the CIS carcinoma in situ BCG unresponsive population was quite promising, 41% complete response rate. But at the end, at the long-term follow-up, meaning 1 year follow-up, the data were promising, like almost 20%, but not so outstanding as they were at the beginning of the story. And the same for atezolizumab. In the SWOG study, atezo monotherapy in BCG unresponsive CIS, similar results at the short-term follow-up and at the long-term follow-up, leading to an almost 16% or 20% complete response rate. A few safety outcomes, a few safety signals. Please don't forget the fact that these patients are primarily managed by urologists, are primarily seen by urologists. So the 10% grade 3-4 adverse event for systemic therapy, including systemic immune therapy, they are very much, as oncologists, are very much used to see in daily clinic, are perceived in a different way in the urology community, meaning that the adherence in the urology community to the use of drugs, to systemic therapy, it may be difficult in this patient population. These are the updated data from the cohort A of the 57, including CIS, BCG unresponsive disease. So again, showing the data that I've anticipated to you with safety signals that they were in line with the use of Pembro in many different settings. And we do have data for Core B or the same study providing the DFS or relapse-free survival in the population of patients with papillary tumor without any CIS component with 40%, 43% short-term relapse-free survival results. What is going on in the front line setting that is currently targeted by the ongoing trials? There is attempt to improve the outcomes as compared to the backbone therapy represented today by BCG. So let's see if trials like POTOMAC trials of KEYNOTE-676 will result in an added value in adding systemic immune therapy over BCG as standard schedule intravesically. These are another obtained in the ADAPT bladder study run in the United States, adding durvalumab monotherapy or durvalumab plus BCG, and including arms with external beam radiotherapy or the combination of durvalumab and gemdosi intravesically. So a multi-arm study that will is aimed to answer many questions related to combination therapy or into combination systemic intravesical therapy. TAR-200 monotherapy has been released recently from the Sunrise platform, in particular the Sunrise-1 study, which is part of the Sunrise platform, investigating TAR-200 monotherapy or in combination with immune checkpoint inhibitor satralimab in the CIS BCG unresponsive patient population. The primary endpoint in this study was in the Sunrise-1 study, so non-muscle invasive CIS disease was a complete response rate assessed centrally with a biopsy at two different time points of 24 and 48 months, so a very stringent definition of complete response. And the data had been updated at ESMO a few months ago, presenting a 76.7% complete response rate at the central review in this patient population. So promising. And most importantly, if you look at the projected duration of complete response at 12 months, it seems that we may overcome substantially the complete response rate at 12 months that is obtained with systemic immune therapy. So a first signal that maybe that the trend in this patient population in terms of research could be focused on the intravesical therapies instead of systemic therapies. Sunrise 3 study, which is part of the Sunrise studies, Sunrise platform study, is targeting the frontline setting, so adds to the POTOMAC KEYNOTE-676 study, investigating TAR-200 or alone or in combination with satralimab as compared to standard BCG therapy. So another study that is challenging the frontline setting in this patient population. And we do have the first approaches with the use of intravesical ADC. So the enfortumab vedotin intravesical use trial is ongoing. The principal investigator is Ashish Kamath, and then we will see whether the promising results proposed many times with the use of EV as a systemic therapy will be confirmed in the intravesical therapy use. So a lot of movement in this patient population, including targeted therapy with FGF receptor inhibitors. You know for sure that FGF receptor and FGF receptor 3 genomic alteration are a consistent target for this patient population. In particular, non-muscle invasive disease is enriched with FGF receptor genomic alteration. So it represents a good target for targeted therapy. Erdafitinib is an orally available pan-FGF receptor inhibitor that has been granted full approval in metastatic disease following chemotherapy and immune therapy, and that's been tested against intravesical chemotherapy in the THOR-2 study, in particular in different cohorts of the patient, but in particular the most robust data being proposed in the what you see indicated as cohort one population, including patients with papillary BCG unresponsive tumor. So the primary endpoint of this study was the disease-free survival. As you know, we cannot use complete response because this patient has already radically resected. So the primary endpoint in this patient population is a disease-free survival. There was a statistically significant improvement in disease-free survival with the use of erdafitinib monotherapy. The point is that the safety outcomes and the safety data from this study were in line with the data that we already gathered from other erdafitinib studies. But look again, going back to the eyes of urologists, the same safety outcome, the safety signals were not seen as being quite well manageable in daily practice, projected in daily practice in this patient population. This is the reason why, despite this, the study actually was positive for the primary endpoint, the impression is that was not seen as so outstanding, providing so outstanding data to be translated so easily in the community of urologists and uro-oncologists, at least at the moment. TAR210 is a way of shifting the paradigm by delivering erdafitinib intravesically. So an outstanding technology here that is providing a way of, like TAR-200 is delivering gemcitabine intravesically. Here we are trying to deliver for the first time in oncology a targeted therapy in the topical way intravesically. And the TAR-210 is a way of delivering erdafitinib intravesically. And the TAR-210 explored different doses of erdafitinib intravesical therapy in different patient population, in different cohort of patients. In particular, the data that have been released at ESMO a few months ago were about the patient population with BCG unresponsive, high-grade Ta/T1, no CIS disease, who has already undergone a radical TURBT. Of course, there was a dose escalation and dose expansion phase of the study, and the initial data provided, in particular, the evidence that the concentration of a systemic erdafitinib when provided intravesically was minimal as compared to the intravenous use. This is the reason why the side effects of intravesical erdafitinib were quite minimal as compared to the systemic and to oral administration of the drug. This is a very good point. For the reason that I have explained to you, for the impact of safety outcomes in this patient population, and the initial data in terms of duration of response or disease-free survival, let's say, in different cohorts of the patients with high-risk BCG-unresponsive disease or intermediate-risk non-muscle-invasive disease were promising. Of course, the follow-up is still short, the numbers are still small, but the impression is that it may change in the near future the paradigm for treatment in this, at least in select patient population, according to the biomarker mutation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, thanks for taking taking us through the treatment of non-muscle invasive disease. So many new treatments coming in through clinical trials. So really an exciting time in this disease. So let's talk a little bit about a case and maybe apply some of those learnings. So this is a 68-year-old patient, ECOG PS1, papillary disease, has an FGFR alteration, has BCG unresponsive disease, so received BCG in the past, develops recurrent papillary disease, undergoes a repeat TURBT, no residual tumor. Let's say this is a TA tumor, high-grade TA tumor. Andrea, how do you approach this patient? What's important in what options are available?
Yeah. Yeah, a paradigmatic case of patients included in trials like those that I presented to you. First of all, it is important to underscore the fact that radical cystectomy still represents the standard of care in this patient population. And all the patients that have been included in clinical trials, regardless of the type of clinical trial, are patients that are fully committed to take the risk of losing the bladder or dying for disease progression while keeping the bladder and trying to keep attempt to save the bladder while receiving any experimental therapy. This is a very important point. Second, if the patient is fully committed to undergo an alternative option, in the cases like this, with FGF receptor alteration, with the papillary disease, this is a typical case that is that may get some benefit or durable benefit from the TAR-210 for intravesical erdafitinib, or oral defitinib also, but with intravesical defitinib, it seems that we may limit the side effects of at least a long run and provide a treatment at the long run with this patient population.
Shilpa, if this was carcinoma in situ, would you approach the case differently, BCG unresponsive carcinoma in situ?
So like Andrea said, radical cystectomy is a valid option, but a lot, you know, most patients don't want that option and or are unfit. But if that is carcinoma in situ, then we currently have systemic pembrolizumab as an approved option for these patients. And there's also nadofaragene that is approved, although the availability is an issue due to production right now. So there are several options for bladder-sparing approaches.
Andrea, there's a lot of gemcitabine docetaxel intravesical use in the United States. Do you see that in Europe?
Well, it's difficult to say because my impression is that we are at the beginning of the story because until now the administration of intravesical chemotherapy is quite infrequent in Europe as compared to the United States. This is the reason why all the trials randomizing patients towards intravesical chemotherapy suffered from poor accrual in the European Union. But things are changing also based on the data that you from the US side are generating, in particular for the use of gemcitabine intravesical therapy. So also urologists, my impression is that they are changing their mind and the treatment administration may rise and may be more frequent in the near future. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Shilpa, there's a question from the audience about the increased use of immune checkpoint blockade in early stage disease, and what do urologists need to know about this?
I think the urologists need to discuss with the patient that there are bladder-sparing approaches, and if that doesn't work, cystectomy is still an option, and refer patients to medical oncologists. In the U.S., you know, urologists are not prescribing immunotherapy, but there's several large practices that have started doing that. So they really need to be aware of the systemic toxicities, because these drugs are for the most part easy to tolerate, but they can have some serious toxicity. So it's important to have a multidisciplinary care team involved.
And Andrea, a question from the audience about TARP 200. You've been involved in some of the trials. So how easy is this to implement in a joint medical oncology urology practice?
Yeah, good question. Of course, there is a learning curve. And we are still at the rising part of the learning curve, so the plateau is still far to be reached, at least in the community. The experience is still now confined in research centers, in the centers in which a trials was open until today. But my impression is that it is a drug that is quite well felt by the urology community, and is quite well tolerated by the patient side, and the side effects are minimal. The side effects presented in the Sunrise 1 study were confined to local side effects or local irritation due to the activity of gemcitabine intravesically. So we will see from the logistical standpoint. We will see if problems may rise in the long run with the multidisciplinary collaboration. But the data since today are very promising in this regard.
Great. Thank you. So let's shift gears to muscle invasive bladder cancer.
Yes, muscle invasive bladder cancer was one of the first clinical models to test neoadjuvant immune therapy just after lung cancer or colon cancer. Bladder cancer is under multiple aspects a good model to test any novel neoadjuvant therapy preoperatively. And then the initial data with the use of systemic immune therapy, immune checkpoint inhibitors as monotherapy were quite promising in terms of pathological complete response rate. The PCR rate were quite consistent, quite good as compared to the PCR data shown and presented with standard chemotherapy. Much more nuances have been reported with the combination of chemo and immunotherapy in this patient population, because the data overall are quite promising. But if you see the numbers, in terms of PCR, it seems that there is no major step forward when adding the backbone chemotherapy over immunotherapy, at least based on the phase 2 single-arm non-randomized studies. And we also have updates from ongoing trials that are almost on the same line In terms of PCR rate, but we are still waiting for mature data on survival data that may change any consideration that we may get to you today in this regard. We tried to do some kind of very difficult effort of trying to make a trial level comparison, retrospective comparison, not individual patient level data comparison of immune therapy versus standard chemotherapy or immune therapy versus upfront radical cystectomy when comparing PURO1 data with Moffitt cohort of chemotherapy or radical cystectomy data, suggesting that there may be some good signal, some good premise for the ongoing randomized phase 3 study. So good premise that should be, of course, confirmed with the ongoing studies with the use of single agent checkpoint inhibitors in this patient population. The ongoing studies, important to say, are not neoadjuvant studies, are perioperative studies. So are studies that are targeting a triple period of time, the neoadjuvant period, the surgical period, and the adjuvant period. So these are studies that are targeting the entire space. And the studies are targeting also not just the single agent immune therapy, but the combination therapy is already there, either neoadjuvantly or adjuvantly in this patient population. Where we have examples shown here of studies whose readout may occur soon with testing in immune therapy with standard GemCis chemotherapy, followed by maintenance adjuvant immune therapy in the experimental arm. All studies testing novel combination therapies like EV Pembro in the Keynote B15 against standard chemotherapy. So very important studies the readout will occur in just a few months, I think. And studies, of course, in cisplatin ineligible population, in chemotherapy ineligible population in this space are also running. The paradigm is the same, neoadjuvant period and adjuvant period. And in this space, there are studies, again, testing EV-Pembro combination or Durva-Tremi-EV combination, or in the case of SunRISe-4, the TAR-200 that you have seen previously in combination with immune checkpoint inhibitor against radical cystectomy. So potentially practice-changing studies, and we will see if the paradigm may change in this patient population. Initial data have been in the post not actually in post-immunotherapy, but in post in a non-immunotherapy setting have been released. Very, very interim findings, very small patient population, showing that we are in the same line of immune checkpoint inhibitors with EV or sacituzumab monotherapy, at least in terms of PCR, which is the only robustly available primary endpoint from these studies. Please don't forget the fact that, for example, if you see the enfortumab vedotin or sacituzumab studies, there are grade 5 events in both of these studies. And losing one single patient in this patient population is a patient that can be potentially cured with the standard of care, with the radical cystectomy. Losing one single patient in this setting is critical in developing new drugs or in new strategy in general in this tumor. In general, I would see the developments of immune therapy or immune combination therapies in this clinical setting with a broader lens, looking not just at the activity or the efficacy of the drugs that we are testing in this patient population, but looking at the advances that we may provide overall to the patient or to the community treating this patient population. These advances, of course, have to do with the way we stage the tumor and the MRI use is something that should be promoted for use in the community and for response evaluation as well. The acquisition of the judgment by urologists is of paramount importance because you can think of everything for the patient, but without the judgment of the urologist and the agreement of the urologist to move towards radical cystectomy, you cannot do nothing basically, or at least you have to change your mind according to the urology judgment. So this is very important to get as a primary information when designing the therapeutic journey for the patient. The patient, of course, the patient side, the patient judgment is important. So the patient judgment in terms of standard chemotherapy administration or radical cystectomy, and Matt here is one of the master testing this paradigm. In case they achieve an outlier response, an outstanding response, and say, okay, doctor, please keep my bladder intact because of the fact that they have achieved such a huge advance, such a huge response with your treatment. Why have to undergo radical cystectomy? This is a rising problem in everyday practice, not in clinical trials. We are dealing with everyday practice in this case. So, and afterwards, after radical surgery, of course, discussing the adjuvant or maintenance therapy according to the type of treatment locally that is delivered to the patients and the type of follow-up that the patient should undergo in depending on the type that you, or the treatment that you are able to deliver in this patient population. So following this discussion, of course, we have initial data that are proposing a novel way of potentially curing the patient with the systemic therapy alone and coupled with a conservative way of removing the tumor in the bladder, meaning the TURBT, so radical resection endoscopically, together with systemic therapy. And initial data from studies attempting to achieve this goal have been proposed, and Matt has published in Nature Medicine a paper that is pivotal in this regard, representing the data with the use of gemcitabine and nivolumab and maintenance nivolumab in patients with a clinical complete response. Nuances are related today about the definition of clinical complete response because there is still heterogeneity in the way we define complete response across the trials that you see here. Shall we include or not include the ctDNA assessment, for example? How can we image the patients with MRI or CT scan? So that the true definition of complete response is still there, but the initial data in terms of maintain complete remission in this patient population are promising. There are multiple attempts, including, again, in the SunRISE platform, the SunRISE 2 study, that is challenging TAR-200 together with cetralimab against chemoradiation as a bladder-sparing approach. In adjuvant setting, of course, we have three major studies, and the tiebreaker has been presented today, the Ambassador study, negative data with atezolizumab in terms of DFS and OS, positive data in terms of with the nivolumab as compared to placebo in terms of DFS, pending the OS data. The tiebreaker was Ambassador study. was really a tiebreaker. The response, the answer is maybe I don't know, because of the fact that the NIVO data and the design of the CheckMate 274 is shown here is pretty well known, were quite promising in terms of the DFS, of course. We are still waiting until a few years of OS data maturing. We have two different labels, all comers in the United States, PD-1 positive population in the European Union. The Ambassador study presented the positive DFS data in the overall, in the ITT population, but again, data, the interim analysis, they were not promising in terms of overall survival in this patient population. So in general, we have two positive studies, NIVO and Pembro, against the one negative study of Atezo. So a lot of potential comment to make, but in general, a signal that we gather today that is supporting the use of adjuvant immune therapy in this patient population. Thank you.
Great, thank you. So another case, this is a case of a patient with muscle-invasive bladder cancer. This is a 52-year-old female marathon runner, excellent shape. She has hematuria, she sees a urologist, undergoes a workup, and has a bladder lesion, ultimately diagnosed with muscle-invasive bladder cancer. She has good renal function, no neuropathy, no hearing loss. She receives 4 cycles of GemCis, standard neoadjuvant chemotherapy, then has radical cystectomy and has pathological residual disease, T3B disease, no lymph nodes involved. So Shilpa, this patient sees you in clinic. How do you counsel them?
So we discussed the next steps after still having high-risk disease despite getting neoadjuvant GemCis, and as CheckMate 274 led by you, Matt, showed disease-free survival benefit of adjuvant nivolumab, that is what I would offer this patient. And we saw that patients who got neoadjuvant treatment benefited more than others, so that was certainly the option to offer to this patient.
Andrea, after seeing Ambassador, so is that still the right choice?
Yes, the opportunity for immunotherapy is still there for a patient like this female, of course. In particular, in patients who have received neoadjuvant chemotherapy, it seems that the benefit from NIVO study and from Pembro study seems to be the most as compared to patients who have chemo-naive and who are cisplatin-ineligible. So in this particular patient population, also when considering the age of this patient, I would opt for proposing, or at least when not available in the standard of care, proposing any kind of new adjuvant immune therapy trial.
Shilpa, any role for ctDNA testing here?
Based on the CheckMate 274, we are not selecting patients based on ctDNA, but as we have learned from the IMvigor 010, which was a negative study, the ctDNA positive patients benefited most in the retrospective analysis, but this would be a great time to consider opening the modern trial led by you, which is especially asking the question of ctDNA positivity and whether we need to intensify treatment with nivolumab.
Are you both ordering ctDNA routinely in practice?
Yes, I'm ordering it.
You are lucky in the United States. Yes. Because we are not so lucky in the European Union. ctDNA assessment is experimental, meaning that we have no, at the moment, commercial test available, in particular reimbursed for use in the community. So actually, in the European Union, as I suspect in many other geographical regions outside the United States, we are dealing with something that is currently not available outside of trials. Yeah.
And it's also only for informative purposes. It's not for treatment decision at this point.
And how about other testing? Are you doing PD-L1 testing?
No.
In any role for genomic testing in a patient like this?
I do genomic testing. The sooner the better, because we know until we test, we won't see if patients have actionable mutations in FGFR3 and if later on they need targeted therapies. That is the only time we use that.
Well, actually, in Europe, based on the label of adjuvant nivolumab, we should test for PD-L1 expression. Mm-hmm. So when in the countries where nivolumab is approved and reimbursed, of course, so we should test for PD-L1 expression.
Mm-hmm. A question came up about the use of adjuvant nivolumab since the label in the United States in routine clinical practice. Are you seeing patients referred to you from community-based practices who've received adjuvant nivo? Do you see this being used?
Yes, we are seeing this uptake of adjuvant nivolumab.
And how about you, Andrea? Something that's used?
Difficult to say. In many countries in the European Union, we have no possibility for getting reimbursement. So I would say that overall in the European Union, the use of adjuvant nivolumab is still confined to 10% of the patient population. Mm-hmm. So meaning that most of the patients that receive adjuvant immune therapy in the European Union are still included in trials or are receiving patient treatment within clinical trials.
There were some questions that came up about bladder sparing and how you make the decision about that, when you make the decision. So of course, in some of these clinical trials, initial systemic treatments given after diagnostic transurethral resection, and then there's a lot of testing that's done to see if patients have responded. But in routine clinical practice, you give a patient 4 cycles of neoadjuvant GemCis. Do you do anything after that, or do they go right to surgery?
They go right to surgery because at this point, we've seen encouraging data again. Your trial with GemCis nivolumab and bladder preservation was really a big step in the right direction. We need more data to offer bladder preservation to these patients, but certainly we need more trials, and the Alliance trial, which is answering such a question, where patients get neoadjuvant cisplatin-based chemotherapy, and then if they have a clinical response and or DDR alterations, they can go on surveillance and chemoradiation accordingly. So I think we need to get more trials to answer that question.
In any case, in daily practice, so in routine practice, whenever a patient refuses a cystectomy upon the evidence of a complete response to a systemic therapy that may be standard chemotherapy, a wise option would be in any case to propose a RET-URBT at least to get the pathological response information and be strong proposals of radical cystectomy in all cases with residual high-grade disease. So I think that we may have the first, an additional step with TURBT and then decide with the patient.
Are you doing that routinely?
Yeah.
How about something even like imaging? Do you routinely image all patients after neoadjuvant chemotherapy?
Yes, before surgery we image all patients and just to make sure they have not progressed during the neoadjuvant treatment, because they don't routinely undergo cystoscopy during neoadjuvant treatment. And then after surgery to make sure they're not progressed, so we can make the decision accordingly.
So what if we look at this same patient again and they had not received neoadjuvant chemotherapy? So T3 disease, node negative disease, no prior chemotherapy, cisplatin eligible. What do you do in that patient?
So we were, if the patient did not receive neoadjuvant and underwent cystectomy?
Right.
So in that case, if depends on whether the patient is cisplatin eligible or not, looks like she's eligible, so I would certainly offer adjuvant gemcitabine and cisplatin-based chemotherapy, as we know from meta-analysis that improves survival.
Yeah, I agree. Also, when looking at the meta-analysis and adjuvant, the ORTC adjuvant study, you see the magnitude of benefit with the adjuvant chemotherapy is the best in higher T stages, not in the lower pathological N stage, meaning that the 3T, 3T4, N0 patient population seems to be the best patient population to get benefit from adjuvant chemotherapy. So I would be in favor of chemotherapy, for course.
Any contraindications to adjuvant immune checkpoint blockade?
Presence of any autoimmune disease for which patients are on systemic immunosuppressants or more than 10 milligrams of prednisone. But cautiously, we can nowadays, you know, getting more bold, working with rheumatologists if patients have a history of some autoimmune disease and discussing the risks and benefits with the patient.
Andrea, you showed several schemas for trials that are using a sandwiched approach, so some neoadjuvant treatment, some adjuvant treatment as well. Given that we know that adjuvant immune checkpoint blockade at least improves disease-free survival, how will we contextualize the results of those studies if patients on the control arm didn't get adjuvant immune checkpoint blockade, and what's the neoadjuvant part doing versus the adjuvant part?
Yeah, good question. If you see other tumor types and the model borrowed, for example, from the studies in melanoma, you see that there may be a huge disparity in terms of outcomes when delivering systemic immune therapy before and after as compared to delivering the same therapy just after surgery. So I suspect that also the same model could be replicated in bladder cancer. So this is the reason why I underscore the fact that the ongoing phase 3 studies are targeting the pre-op and the post-op space and may provide even different outcomes also when dealing with the DFS part of the post-operative setting. So the pre-op part may have an impact, a potentially huge impact also in the DFS in the patient population after surgery. So things may change substantially, and our judgment in terms of adjuvant therapy use may change substantially based on the readout of the ongoing neoadjuvant studies.
And you showed a few schemas with neoadjuvant EV Pembro and some early data with neoadjuvant EV, but have we seen any data with EV Pembro in the neoadjuvant setting, even single arm studies so far?
Not yet.
Not yet.
Okay, thanks. So let's move on. Something that's coming up more frequently as immune checkpoint blockade is being used across disease states in bladder cancer and in other solid tumors is whether or not there are ways to administer treatment differently. That is, administer treatment subcutaneously. Many of the drugs that we're used to using, drugs that we've been administering intravenously, are now being developed as subcutaneous formulations. And then there are some drugs that are being developed just initially as subcutaneous formulations, such as sasanlimab. And so certainly there are potential advantages of this in our infusion units to be able to have patients just come in for a sub-Q treatment. I think, you know, in particular, this is attractive in the perioperative setting. Patients don't necessarily have disease-related burden, potentially or particularly in the adjuvant setting. And so coming in, not having to have an IV placed, allowing a quick sub-Q injection is potentially attractive. We're going to see some results in kidney cancer regarding subcutaneous nivolumab. And of course, we've seen some results in other solid tumors using subcutaneous approaches. So I think we're going to be seeing more of this. Another plug for the Beacon website. There is a really nice tool on the Beacon website that allows one to search for clinical trials related to bladder cancer. You can restrict those based on geographic regions. If anyone's tried to search clinicaltrials.gov for a friend or family member for a clinical trial, it's really difficult to navigate in terms of finding something that's relevant and nearby. And so this really narrows this down for individuals with bladder cancer. It's a really nice resource. So as mentioned, bladder cancer is a team sport, really requires a multidisciplinary approach. And this is the case not only in the non-muscle invasive and muscle invasive setting, but in the metastatic setting as well. And just like in the early stage disease setting, there's lots of unmet needs in the metastatic setting. Some of these are related to implementation science. Some of them are related to accessibility. So we know that about half of patients with metastatic urothelial cancer don't receive any first-line systemic treatment. And of course, all of us see some of those patients just based on the very aggressive biology of the disease, sometimes diagnosed initially with metastatic disease during a hospitalization because of complications from that disease. So of course, this is a disease that has very heterogeneous behavior and can really be quite aggressive. In patients who receive frontline systemic treatment for metastatic urothelial cancer, if you look at observational data historically, there's a huge drop-off between frontline and second-line therapy. About half of patients who get frontline therapy do not receive subsequent lines of therapy. We think maybe this is going to change as the frontline treatments get better and maybe alter the natural history of the disease, but that remains to be seen. With all of the new therapies that have been developed in this disease, we really don't have a great sense for whether or not sequencing matters. So we have new tools, but whether or not we start with chemo and then go to IO and ADCs, or ADCs are best given first, we really don't have clinical trials to help sort that out. In those really practical questions are something that have been answered in other diseases much better, like prostate cancer, and I think we're going to see more of those studies in urothelial cancer. So let's talk a little bit about metastatic disease. And everything changed at ESMO this past year, and we saw two randomized phase 3 trials in ESMO, which we'll talk about a bit more. But leading up to ESMO, in the 5 years leading up to ESMO, there were a large number of phase 3 trials in frontline treatment of metastatic urothelial cancer that read out. And arguably, there were more studies that read out during that period of time than probably read out in the prior 20 years before that in frontline treatment. So lots of new data, in lots of surprises as well. Some of the strategies that we thought would work in metastatic urothelial cancer because they worked in other solid tumors didn't work in this disease. And so I think lots of lessons learned, and we can't necessarily take something that's worked in lung cancer and apply it to urothelial cancer, probably for a number of reasons. The study that was somewhat surprising, I think, to many people as the study that really ended up showing a dramatically favorable result was the switch maintenance approach. So you're all familiar with this Javelin Bladder 100 study. This involved patients who had received initial systemic chemotherapy, platinum-based chemotherapy, for metastatic urothelial cancer. And after achieving at least stable disease, patients were randomized to receive switch maintenance of avelumab versus observation. And you can see the overall survival benefit primary endpoint shown here, leading to FDA approval of this regimen, integration into standard practice guidelines. And this really has been a standard of care for the past several years since these results were reported. There's a need to improve upon that. In one approach to improve upon switch maintenance treatment is to see whether or not we could give combination therapies in the switch maintenance setting, which may overcome mechanisms of intrinsic resistance to immune checkpoint blockade. And so one of those studies being led by Dr. Gupta, a national study being done through the Alliance, is the MAINCAF study. And this is really similar to Javelin Bladder 100, but instead of a randomization to avelumab versus observation, it's standard of care avelumab now versus avelumab plus cabozantinib, based on data that suggests that cabozantinib might have a number of potential effects, modulating the tumor microenvironment that may allow enhanced immunomodulatory effect with immune checkpoint blockade. And so this study is currently enrolling, and please support that study. There were several studies in the frontline setting, as mentioned, that didn't read out necessarily the way that we anticipated. And two of those were IMvigor 130 and Keynote 361, and these were designed really similarly. Three-arm studies answering probably what was felt to be the most important questions at the time, which is, in patients with metastatic urothelial cancer, should we be giving single-agent immune checkpoint blockade? Should we just keep giving chemotherapy the way that we were, platinum-based chemotherapy, or should we give chemotherapy plus immune checkpoint blockade? Now, these were really the first generation of studies in metastatic urothelial cancer where the control arm was pooled cisplatin-eligible and cisplatin-ineligible patients. So it was really dealer's choice based on what a patient was appropriate for, and same thing on the experimental arm with combination therapy. So gem-cis plus atezo or gem-carbo plus atezo. And that was really done for pragmatic reasons. In fact, there were a couple of editorials written probably about 15 to 20 years ago now that made the case that we needed to do trials like that because, you know, we don't remember this with six phase three trials reading out in the past few years in frontline treatment of metastatic urothelial cancer, but it was really hard to finish metastatic urothelial cancer trials, you know, 15 years ago. So that was proposed for pragmatic reasons, but, you know, sometimes we don't completely consider what the potential biological implications of those decisions might be. And what I'm alluding to is that neither of those studies met their overall survival endpoint. You know, again, a surprise based on what we've seen in other solid tumors. But if you look at subset analyses from both of those studies, so here's IMvigor 130 and Keynote 361, and now we're looking at progression-free survival according to whether or not patients got cis or carbo and added the immune checkpoint blockade. And you see the effect of adding the immune checkpoint inhibitor is much more substantial when patients receive cisplatin as the backbone versus carboplatin. There are some potential immunomodulatory mechanisms for this. In fact, a paper was just published today suggesting why this might be the case. But ultimately, the test of this concept is doing a study where patients only get cisplatin-based chemotherapy plus or minus immune checkpoint blockade. And luckily, we have that experiment, and that's CheckMate 901. So CheckMate 901 was presented at ESMO this past year. And this is a study which is designed similarly to those other studies that I mentioned, but here patients are only included if they're cisplatin eligible. So frontline treatment, metastatic urothelial cancer, cisplatin eligible, randomized to treatment with gemcitabine cisplatin plus nivolumab or gemcitabine cisplatin alone. And then there is a continued maintenance nivolumab after the six cycles of gem cis nivo on the study. Here's the overall survival primary endpoint. You see a survival benefit when you add immune checkpoint blockade to cisplatin-based chemotherapy with a hazard ratio of 0.78. And here's the progression-free survival from the study, and you see something similar. You see the curves start to separate a little bit later, but they stay separated for some time with a hazard ratio of 0.72 for progression-free survival. Importantly, you do see this translate into the secondary endpoints of the study as well, including the objective response rate. So you see a bump in the response rate when you add immune checkpoint blockade, and this was really not seen as clearly in those studies where the platinum was either cis or carbo. And importantly, the complete clinical response rate goes up with the combination treatment as well, so 21% versus 11.8%. But interestingly, and I think this is an important message from this study, is that not only is there a quantitative increase in the complete response rate, but there's qualitative differences. So a complete response is not a complete response depending on the regimen that gets you there. And you can see the median duration of complete response with GemCisNevo was 37 months, and it was 13.2 months with GemCis alone. So the regimen has the potential in some patients to induce these deep responses, which are quite sustained. Here's the treatment-related adverse events with GemCisNevo, and not too dissimilar to what we've seen in other studies combining immune checkpoint blockade and chemotherapy, which is that you tend to see side effects related to the different components of the regimens, but not necessarily synergistic side effects in terms of an increase in immune-related adverse events when you give chemotherapy along with immune checkpoint blockade, and not an increase in cisplatin-related toxicity when you give the immune checkpoint blockade together with it. This question of chemotherapy plus immune checkpoint blockade was the big question several years ago. So several studies were launched at the same time, and we've seen all of those read out at this point, except this is the remaining study. So this is NILE, and it's asking a similar question, but a little bit of a nuance. So here it's a quadruplet regimen: durvalumab, tremelimumab, so PD-L1 blockade plus CTLA-4 blockade, along with platinum-based chemotherapy. Now, similar to IMvigor 130 and KEYNOTE 361, this study did include any platinum-based chemotherapy as the control arm and as the backbone, the chemotherapy backbone on the experimental arms. There was a cap for carboplatin-based chemotherapy on this study of 20%, so we'll see if that makes the difference, if the platinum really does matter at the end of the day. Actually, we have just a couple of minutes, so I'm going to take some of the audience questions. And so this really is back to the prior discussion about muscle-invasive bladder cancer, and this is a tough one, but maybe she'll ask you this. So if there's an FDA approval for Pembro in the adjuvant setting, Pembro or Nevo?
I'll toss a coin.
Okay, fair enough. There's a question about a phase 3 trial of the 16257 study in the future. So how are we going to integrate systemic therapy plus TURBT as a bladder sparing approach? What's the definitive level of evidence that gets that into a standard of care? And I think, you know, phase 3 studies in that space, we've thought a lot about how you would do that. I don't think it's straightforward. I think there's a lot of phase 2 studies that will provide complementary evidence and confidence to get us to the phase 3 study. I don't know if either of you have thoughts about a phase 3 study in that setting.
As you mentioned, it's difficult to envision because of the fact that by definition, these studies are flexible enough to afford the patient decision that may change depending on the treatment and depending on the response to treatment. So finding a comparator arm would mean finding a flexible comparator arm depending on the situation, the shifting situation while on treatment. So it is extremely... Basically, I'm prepared to answer this question to the patient first and to the regulators afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Great. Shilpa, you want to take us through a beyond checkpoint inhibitor regimens?
Thank you, Matt, and Andrea for walking us so elegantly and ahead of time. So we'll talk about what next after checkpoint inhibitors, and we have seen a lot of exciting data. So let's talk about enfortumab vedotin and pembrolizumab as first-line therapy for cisplatin-ineligible advanced urothelial cancer first. So as you recall, this was from the EV-103 study, cohort A and cohort K. We saw some really exceptional early data. Even just cohort A was only 40 patients, and we saw these remarkable initial data. And then maximum reduction from baseline was seen in majority of patients in this patient population. with 74% responses. And then when we presented the four-year follow-up from this cohort A last year at ASCO annual meeting, you can see how the duration of response was so well maintained. The median duration of response was 22 months. The tail of the curve was very well maintained here. Again, with the progression-free survival by BICR and overall survival by BICR was in great concordance with investigator-initiated initial report. And as you can see here, again, four-year follow-up for cisplatin-ineligible patients who, before advent of immunotherapy, had only median overall survival of 6 to 9 months. You can see the beautiful tail of the curve here. 41% patients were progression-free at 2 years, and median overall survival was more than 2 years. So this was very promising data, and we saw at ESMO 2023, the phase three study, which was for locally advanced metastatic urothelial cancer patients who were previously untreated with platinums, with the exception of neoadjuvant or adjuvant treatment, it was over a year before enrolling, and they had to be immunotherapy naive. Minimum GFR was 30 or more. ECOG performance status was less than equal to 2, but for patients with ECOG performance status 2, they really needed to be fit with adequate hemoglobin and not your classic ECOG 2 that we see in the real world. Patients were stratified based on cisplatin eligibility and PD-L1 expression as well as liver metastases, because we have seen from EV-103 that enfortumab really has this exquisite activity in the liver metastases, even as monotherapy from other trials. Patients were randomized to standard of care chemotherapy, GemCis or GemCarbo, up to 6 cycles, versus EV pembrolizumab. Pembrolizumab was maximum 35 cycles, and there was no end duration for EV. I want to highlight here that the dosing of EV was day 1, day 8, every 21 days, as opposed to the monotherapy dosing, which is day 1, day 8, 15, every 28 days. Primary endpoint was progression-free survival by BICR and overall survival, and there were key secondary endpoints of response rates. And we saw the update here at our ASCO GU meeting, but this was the data we saw, remarkable improvement in overall survival, hazard ratio 0.47, with 31.5 months OS with EV pembro compared to 16 months with chemotherapy, so nearly doubling of the OS. Improved progression-free survival with EV pembro, again, hazard ratio 0.45, 6.3 versus 12.5 months. And this was, the risk of progression or death was reduced by 55% in patients who got EV pembro. Really unprecedented results we have ever seen. Overall responses, again, 37% patients had complete responses, 29% patients had partial responses compared to much lower seen with chemotherapy. And again, we can see here a lot of patients had stable disease. And at ASCO GU today, we saw the subgroup analysis, which delved deeper into cisplatin eligibility and PD-L1 expression, which historically we knew the patients may respond better with the PD-L1 expressing tumors. We saw that the overall benefit was well maintained regardless of cisplatin eligibility or PD-L1 expression. And liver metastases and other metastatic disease sites also, EV pembro fared significantly better than standard of care chemotherapy. The adverse events is a different, very different with EV pembro compared to chemotherapy, but we have to understand that the key unique toxicities are skin reactions, which can really be life-threatening or even fatal if not taken care of and doses not held or dose reduced eventually. Peripheral neuropathy can be disabling with EV pembro, something we've not seen with GemCis up to 6 cycles. So we have to really be cautious about all these side effects and not take them lightly. We can get ocular disorders, which are pretty easy to manage with dose reductions, dose interruptions. Catastrophic hyperglycemia can be seen in patients who are not previously diabetic. You know, we have seen patients who develop diabetic ketoacidosis with even single agent EV. So these are some unique toxicities that we need to learn how to manage, but skin reactions and peripheral neuropathy are clearly the most common adverse events. And this slide really gives an insight into when to expect these toxicities. The skin reaction tends to occur very early on within the first couple of cycles. And if we hold the doses, reduce the doses, start steroids, it improves and resolves very quickly. Peripheral neuropathy, on the other hand, the onset is about 2.4 months, and the improvement may take over 6 to 7 months, and resolution, if at all, would be very late. So we have to be very proactive with dose reductions and a thorough physical exam for the skin rash, as well as a neuro exam, including gait test and grip test, and make the patient walk. Hyperglycemia, again, occurs early on, very easy to check with lab work, and easy to manage also, but something to be very careful about. And we saw in the phase 3 EV-302, these are the adverse event profiles. Keep in mind the myelosuppression, of course, from the chemotherapy was a different class effect as opposed to EV-pembro. There were serious treatment-related adverse events in about 28% patients receiving EV-pembro and about 20% patients receiving chemotherapy. And there were some toxic deaths, about 4 deaths, which is less than 1% in the EV-pembro arm, and in the chemotherapy arm also similar. So, but the side effect profile, we are used to the platinum side effect profile. Now I have to get used to the EV-pembro side effect profile. And there are several tactics for managing the safety. Again, like I said, for skin reactions, it's always important to do a physical exam of the patient, tell the patient not to take the skin rash lightly, inform your clinical team. Peripheral neuropathy, at every visit, ask the patient. They may underreport symptoms many times. Do the exam. If there's ocular disorders, refer to, these are usually corneal toxicities, refer to ophthalmologist. Hyperglycemia, monitor the blood glucose. If it's more than 200, do not give EV until it's controlled. In the trial, they did not enroll patients with uncontrolled diabetes. The hemoglobin A1C cutoff was 8, so be careful about that. And there can also be pneumonitis with this. It's difficult to understand whether it's from EV or pembro, so you have to stop one drug first and see how the patient does and start steroids. I just want to highlight why platinum ineligibility is important, because the EV-302 study only enrolled platinum-eligible patients. As you can imagine, that was the control arm. So we want to know what are the patient characteristics which may deem them platinum ineligible, so they would be really frail to not even be eligible to get carboplatin. And those are the patients you would not readily want to give EV-pembro to, because it can be very toxic on a case-by-case basis. And we, along with Dr. Galsky, had proposed some consensus criteria, and this tells you patients are really frail. You know, ECOG performance status 3 or higher, creatinine clearance less than 30, peripheral neuropathy greater than equal to grade 2, and heart failure. And in the EV-302 trial, patients with creatinine clearance less than 30 were not enrolled. So we have to be careful about these patients. And there's a lot of new antibody drug conjugates on the horizon. That's the next wave of therapeutic options for urothelial cancer. And targeting HER2 is one of those antibody drug conjugates with dasatinib, vedotin, and the PD-1 inhibitor. That combination showed impressive response rates in a small study in frontline setting, 76%. There's an ongoing phase 3 trial. Then there's the trastuzumab, deruxtecan, T-DXd. A lot of you may know that from the breast cancer world. And then in the pan-tumor O2, there's a bladder cancer cohort. Previously treated patients showing encouraging activity, 39%. So we'll see what the future data shows and where targeting HER2 fits in our paradigm. Targeting TROP2 with sacituzumab govitecan, it has accelerated approval in the U.S. based on single-arm trial for patients who have received prior platinums and prior immunotherapy. That was the TROPHY-U01 trial. We saw around 28% response rates. And the phase 3 TROPICS-04 trial has completed accrual. We are waiting for some data, whether it improves overall survival compared to standard of care dealer's choice chemotherapy in the refractory setting. That would be the confirmatory trial. Talking about the FGFR alterate, altered patients with FGFR altered tumors in the metastatic or unresectable setting. Dr. Necki covered the NMIBC and MIBC setting, and this drug is already approved in metastatic setting. The initial trial that got this approval was the phase 2 BLC2001 erdafitinib monotherapy trial. The drug was approved in 2019 based on promising response rates, duration of response, PFS and OS. And the phase 3 trial, which was the confirmatory trial called the TOR trial, showed us that it was better than chemotherapy in the refractory setting. And more recently at ESMO, we also saw when should the FGFR inhibitor be used. And this was a big question up until last year. If, let's say, a patient has received platinums and has alteration in the FGFR, should we use immunotherapy first or erdafitinib first? And we really did not know a systematic, we didn't have systematic data, and we were just using our own judgment. But this trial, the TOR trial, also provided this information on the sequencing of whether to use erdafitinib first or pembrolizumab first. And so this is the cohort one, which we saw that erdafitinib is better than chemotherapy, and this should definitely be used in patients who have FGFR alterations. And we won't know about that until we do the genetic testing, so it's really important to do that. As you can see here, response rates 45.6% with erdafitinib versus only 11.5% with chemo. And again, this is the standard of care. And the cohort two showed us that use of pembrolizumab before erdafitinib is the preferred approach. This was the negative trial. The hypothesis was that we should use erdafitinib before pembrolizumab, but the data showed us that pembrolizumab should be used first. More recently, we had an updated FDA label that any prior one-line therapy in metastatic urothelial cancer patients, we can use erdafitinib if they have the FGFR alterations, but that one the patient should have received immunotherapy if it's just one line or be ineligible. Erdafitinib is an oral therapy, but it is certainly not an easy drug to give, and Dr. Necki touched upon that before. Patients can get really bad hyperphosphatemia. We really need to, this is a class effect. We need to check their labs frequently and do dietary phosphate, phosphate restriction, consult a nutritionist. Ocular toxicities can be quite serious with this, as opposed to the enfortumab vedotin toxicities. It can lead to retinal detachment. It can lead to serious retinopathy. Have to be very careful in patients who already have those problems if they're diabetics, or you need to have an ophthalmologist at hand to refer these patients. And of course, goes without saying, the nail and the skin toxicities can be quite debilitating for patients, so it's important to check in and hold the doses, reduce the doses proactively. Thank you.
Great, thank you. So keep your questions coming. I see a lot of them coming through. I think we're going to address some of these in the next case, but of course, those that we don't address in the case will come to next. So submit additional questions, please. So this is Nathan. This is a patient who's 65 years old, presents with hematuria, diagnosed with urothelial cancer, has a CAT scan that shows multiple enlarged lymph nodes in the retroperitoneum and pelvis. Creatinine clearance is 60, performance status is 1, no neuropathy, no hearing loss, no FGFR alterations, no autoimmune disease, not on chronic steroids. So what options does Nathan have now and in the future, in what's going to be the optimal approach for Nathan? Say you had all of the treatment options available that you just covered. What's the best approach?
So if we had the all the treatment options available, which is EV Pembro and GemCis Nivolumab, so as we can see, based on the Galski criteria, patient meets the criteria for GemCis. So combining GemCis Nivolumab would be a very good option. EV Pembro is also a great option. As you have seen the discussion at ESMO, I think our preferred option would be to use EV Pembro for this patient. But if I were in a setting where EV Pembro is not available for a variety of reasons, then I would use GemCis Nivolumab for this patient upfront.
Andrea.
Clearly, the EV Pembro data and today with the subgroup analysis that this information has been confirmed, no question that there is a huge difficulty in identifying a patient population who may not benefit from EV Pembro combination. But at the same time, as you mentioned in your presentation, we have to dig a little bit more on the complete responders from chemo GemCis nivolumab trial, because the duration of complete responses is compelling in this study. So I suspect that these patient populations, so complete responder population, are enriched in patients presenting with oligometastatic disease, lymph node only disease. So maybe the patient like this one, like Nathan, presenting with the oligometastatic nodal disease, may be part of the complete responders and long-term complete responders in this study. So, of course, EV Pembro first choice, but short after maybe the chemo IO combination.
Is there a role for maintenance of OMA?
Not if we are using the frontline immunotherapy-based regimens.
And how about if there was an FGFR alteration in this patient?
So the frontline approach would still be the ADC IO or GemCis IO, and then if they progress on that, we would use the FGFR inhibitor.
Andrea, say you treat this patient with EV Pembro and they get a rash. Is that a good thing in terms of predicting response to treatment?
Not as far as we know. There is no the issue of side effects preceding or maybe anticipating a response is quite tough in general in oncology when dealing with immune therapy, with only a few exceptions. So but not for sure in bladder cancer. We don't have any information that may support. With robust data from trials, any association between toxicity development and response to treatment, at least at the moment.
And there were lots of questions about rash. So take us through how do you approach a patient, cycle one, or cycle two, day one, comes in with a rash. How do you approach that patient?
Yeah, so I immediately, I tell the patient, we won't treat you with EV Pembro today, or at least, I hold the EV first, and then start the topical steroids, refer to dermatologist, depending on the severity of the rash, if it doesn't improve with topical steroids. And if the rash still doesn't get better over the next few days, I also hold pembrolizumab, and then start the systemic dose of steroids with 1 milligram per kilogram of prednisone. So rash is nothing to be taken lightly, and it's always okay to not treat the patient and let the rash get better.
In you certainly have access to dermatologists. Say someone doesn't have access to dermatologists. Do you find that? Do your dermatologists do a lot of biopsies on these patients?
Not routinely unless we ask them to. So it's always a good idea to start them on steroids if you don't have access to dermatologists. Mm-hmm. And I think even doing a biopsy will not change the management per se.
Sure. Andrea, any pearl?
Well, and one thing and an advice could be for the community to consider, besides the referral to dermatologists, to consider in each case the biopsy in each case of rash, cutaneous rash due to the infortuma, because we may get signals or information that may portend or anticipate somehow the potential for developments of Stevens-Johnson syndrome or similar syndromes that may be quite impactful for the patient. So biopsying the lesions is a good thing to know and to accumulate this information for the patients.
How about neuropathy? You mentioned in your presentation some specific testing that you do.
Yeah, I make the patient walk, because a lot of patients have motor neuropathy. They've been falling at home, but when you ask them, they typically, in my experience, they underreport their symptoms on treatments when they're having a good response. But with chemotherapy, they always tend to overreport their symptoms. So you'll hear about side effects if they're on chemo. But sometimes, when a patient says, no, I don't have neuropathy, and you make them walk, you're seeing they have a waddling gait, they're really, and then you talk to their family members that, oh yeah, they've been struggling to walk at home. So those are really big time signals to back off from the EV. and also check for peripheral neuropathy and motor strength, just using simple tests like the grip test, and it's easy to do.
And when you see a patient with some gait instability like that, do you drop the dose or do you hold at that point?
I stop the dose. Stop. And until they get better, I do not resume.
And if they're on combination therapy, continue pembro?
Continue the pembrolizumab, yes.
How about glucose monitoring, Andrea? Do you find that to be challenging with EV? Do you run into issues with having to hold the dose for hyperglycemia?
I would say very infrequently, provided the patient present with the basal control. So it may happen, but in the daily clinic, it is not very frequent in patients that are under control, even having the diabetes. Yeah.
And a question came up a little bit going back to our prior discussion about subcutaneous formulations. Do you see subcutaneous dosing playing a role in your practice?
Yeah, I think it may play a role. You know, in our practice, they will still have to go to the infusion center to get the subcutaneous. But I know there's a lot of practices where you can give it in the room when you're seeing the patient. So I think eventually it will reduce our chair time and we can get more patients in, so it'll be good.
Well, potentially the impact may be quite high for the subcutaneous infusion because we have currently a huge problem in the infusion centers to provide the patient in a treatment in a timely manner. So the weekly administrations of enfortumab are a problem, may represent a growing problem in the near future. So shifting the way of administering the treatment may be quite impactful for the patient population, yeah.
So we saw a series of phase 3 studies in the metastatic setting, first-line treatment readout over several years. And then what's next? So post-ESMO this past year, what are the next big studies? What are you intrigued about in metastatic urothelial cancer?
The NILE study, we're looking forward to that to see how the, Durva, Tremi plus platinums versus Durva and platinum will fare out. Granted, the control arm is a bit outdated now if they did not get maintenance immunotherapy. I think it is great to see all these options coming up.
And there's still the issue of CTLA-4 blockade, metastatic urothelial cancer, still not completely answered. There's still one endpoint in CheckMate 901 that hasn't read out. Andrea, what are you most excited about?
Well, it's interesting to realize that on one side we have a treatment for attempts for a treatment intensification by adding more and more drugs frontline. But on the other side, there are studies like the DISCO studies in the European Union, UK and the European Union, that are trying to answer the opposite question of de-escalation therapy in patients with more indolent disease, oligometastatic disease. So maybe providing less chemotherapy, for example, the DISCO trial is aimed to provide less cycles of chemotherapy and anticipating the maintenance avelumab approach. So it's interesting that we have two different directions that the research is taking. On one side, intensifying treatments may be for, it is applicable as a paradigm for more aggressive disease patients, and on the other side, it attempts to de-intensify treatment for patients who present with more indolent disease, for example, a relapse after more than 1 year of neoadjuvant or neoadjuvant therapy, lymph node disease, slowly growing disease, and so on. So we have to take two different directions first, and then we have to decide which kind of approach, a therapeutic approach, we may take in this direction. Yeah.
Any role for ctDNA testing in the metastatic disease setting?
We have been using it for immune monitoring for informational purposes, not for decision making, but I think that is again speaking towards de-escalation strategies. If a patient is doing really well, scans look really good, ctDNA is negligible or negative, then talk about sparing them unnecessary treatment. Mm-hmm. I think that would be the way to go.
And what are your thoughts about that?
My impression is that the applicability of ctDNA at the large scale in metastatic setting is much more nuanced and difficult. to propose for a cost limitation first, but also for a scientific standpoint, because we for sure lack of a biomarker, liquid biomarker in this disease. We don't have a PSA to monitor in this disease. But on the other side, CT scan or imaging may be sufficient enough to make decisions in the metastatic setting. So at the moment, I don't see any big change in the routine applicability of ctDNA use in these patients.
How about instead of MRD monitoring but looking for genomic alterations, can you use FGFR3 alterations in the blood to inform treatment with erdafitinib?
Yes, if they don't have tissue available, I use that in the blood.
And do you see that there's a good correlation between blood-based FGFR3 alterations and response to treatment?
Yeah.
What therapeutic targets are you most excited about in metastatic disease? What's coming next?
I think the reinvigoration of the HER2, and there's a lot of new ADCs on the block, and then there's the anti-TIGIT antibody and the LAG pathway. So there's a lot of new drugs coming along, and we are really excited about moving the field forward with these.
Yeah, I agree with her too. The good thing is to try to move as much as possible into the targeted therapy direction, because one way of overcoming the huge data and the huge advances that have been made with EV Pembro is to try to focus a little bit more smarter enough to try to select patients and not to treat all comers in the next trials and maybe translate the data into the community. So the targeted therapy approach of any kind may be a winning strategy in the near future.
How about doublet or even triplet antibody drug conjugates? Should we be combining these drugs?
I think the toxicity is pretty concerning. You know, now that we have EV Pembro as a standard, I think it will be really difficult to beat it with adding another ADC at the, especially when the toxicity is so high. But I think certainly in refractory setting, we should think of non-overlapping ADCs. At this point, I'm pretty happy with what we have in the frontline setting.
Mm-hmm. Andrea.
Yeah, the counter argument may be to lose, and the risk may be to lose too many options in the therapeutic journey for the patients. It's true that today we are lucky to have many options and many trials available for the patients, but they are not unlimited. So losing the possibility and losing the game of two ADCs and the one simultaneously at a certain point, it may be in fact for the patients if we do not see any major impact at the medium long term. So at this point in time, I would still prefer to use the ADCs in the sequence, in the sequential approach rather than in combination therapy. But we need more data on combination therapies.
And we really didn't touch on it during this session, but at ESMO, phase one data, enfortumab plus sacituzumab, single center study, not a huge study, but 70% response rate with the combination. So I think I certainly agree with all your points about being cautious in that setting. But scientifically, there's a lot of rationale. Maybe targeting different cells using non-cross-resistant payloads.
Yeah, or maybe when thinking, for example, the positive readout of early stage trials like perioperative studies, we should be prepared for the fact that more and more patients will come to the metastatic setting having already received an ADC plus an IO compound. So the point of combination therapy may be applicable in particular to this patient population, depending on previous response, depending on time to disease progression and so on. But more and more patients will be managed frontline in the near future. This is beyond the corner, having already received a substantial amount of treatment preoperatively.
So I just want to make sure that we cover all the questions, and there's one question that we really didn't touch on, which is really an older chemotherapy question, but with some more recent data generated in the past year or so. Chemotherapy in the neoadjuvant setting, docetaxel versus gemcitabine.
Yeah, so my preference is to use GemCis. You know, the dose-dense MVAC data, we saw the median age of patients was 60. In our practice, it's really in their 70s. unless a patient is very young and very robust, I do GEMSYS. That has been our standard, and all the trials that we have, the partner is GEMSYS. So 6 cycles of dose dense MVAC can be a bit much, and you know, as it is, our utilization of neoadjuvant chemotherapy is not more than 30-some%, and if we start mandating for dose dense MVAC with the toxicities, I don't think it will serve us and may even impact it negatively.
Well, we love to use dose dense MVAC historically in our center for many reasons. For logistical reasons, first, in order to avoid the D8 of gemcitabine that make problems for infusion centers, but also for to make the paradigm as compact as possible and to make patients good enough and fit enough to undergo radical surgery in a timely manner. With the use of PEG GCSF, the toxicity is quite manageable. Unfortunately, the MVAC has not been historically a good backbone for combination therapies, so it has been neglected for many years. Too toxic combination therapy, but in fact, at least in select centers, in the high volume centers, is maybe the first choice for the patient population. Also based on the VESPER study, the French study that compared somehow these two different approaches and presenting and publishing data that are in support of the use of this regimen.
Thank you. And thank you both for your insights. Really, really wonderful insights tonight. And thank you everyone for listening and for submitting questions. And have a great evening. Thank you.
This activity is certified by PVI, Peerview Institute for Medical Education. This activity is developed with our educational partner, Bladder Cancer Advocacy Network. Remember to download the slides and practice aids. Thank you for listening. Download materials and complete the post-test for instant credit at peerview.com/JSQ860. This activity is supported through independent educational grants from AstraZeneca, Bristol-Myers Squibb, Janssen Biotech Incorporated, administered by Janssen Scientific Affairs, LLC, Merck & Company, Incorporated, and Seagen and Astellas.